Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, it's Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and it's a spring Monday here in Brooklyn. It's starting to get a little bit more spring-like as the days go on. So, as we are in the middle of a sort of in-between season, I think it's always really fun for me to play around with different cuisines, try out some new techniques in the kitchen, and I'm holding a cookbook right now that is all about one certain cuisine, and you know, I just love cookbooks that are about a single cuisine and culture. I think I'm actually trying to collect a book for every part of the world. But this book is actually much more than just a cookbook. It is called Mint Tea and Minarets, A Banquet of Moroccan Memories. And its author, Kitty Morse, is on the line here. How are you, Kitty?
Hi, Kathy. I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining. And
pleasure.
Yeah. So Kitty, you're the author of several cookbooks already, award-winning ones. And you've written, you know, a lot about Moroccan food. So you have Couscous that came out in 2000, My Moroccan Kitchen, Cooking at the Casbah, Recipes from My Moroccan Kitchen.
Right.
And so this book is it's a little bit more than a cookbook, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's a departure, you know, mm-hmm. After writing five books strictly on Moroccan cuisine, I thought, my father willed me this Riyadh. Riyadh is a Moorish mansion, mm-hmm. about 90 kilometers south of Casablanca, and I was going back and forth because for over 20 years I led food tours to Morocco, and I would go to the name of the house is Darzitoun, the House of the Olive, and I would give cooking classes. Uh-huh. And I always wanted to tell more stories, because one of the frustrations when you're a cookbook author, maybe you know that, is when you have to write a headline, you write a really nice headline and it takes you, a head note, and right. It takes you weeks and weeks, really, weeks. And then your editor slashes and burns and says, oops, we only have 200, you know, room for 200 words. And I thought, all of a sudden, yeah. My Moroccan stories were slashed, which was fine. I love my books, but I've always wanted to tell more stories. And because of the history and the background of this house, it was absolutely something I had to do, and it took me 12 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yes. I don't recommend doing this, on a regular basis, but, so I've told the story of my life in Morocco, growing up in Morocco, what happens when I go to Darzitoun, and also, of course, within the walls of this magical house.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. Actually, I think that the book itself is fascinating, but all the layers of history in this house that
yes.
you have beautifully, told in such detail. It's just like it's really like reading a novel, but it's actually a memoir. It's your own life.
Yeah. Yes, it is. But thank you. And it was, it's a very personal book. I think that's why it took me so long, because I had so many more stories to tell, and I had to slash and burn my own manuscript. But while I was researching this, which my father purchased a pile of ruins in the mid-60s.
Okay.
And then he spent 20 years restoring it, and of course we went back and forth. And it was his weekend house, because he lived in Casablanca, and he purchased this on the lark in a village that hardly anybody goes to unless you have good reason to, on the banks of Morocco's main river, the Mother of Spring. But while I was researching, I spoke to my neighbors and to previous owners of the house before the 1960s, and I found out that Darzitun was a cooking venue.
Oh, my goodness.
And yes, and it really, it sent chills up and down my spine. I couldn't, I was just stunned because I was going there to cook. My father's wife was a fabulous cook. The book is also about my relationship with Bouchaïb, our caretaker/cook. So we cooked. So we did at Darzitun. We cooked and we ate and we invited people to cook and eat.
So you were having these cooking classes at your father's restored riad and all the while hadn't yet discovered that this was the place of a cooking school.
A century or a century and a half before, the owner and probably one of the rebuilders of the house was a rich man from the north of Morocco, from Tetouan, which has quite a different cuisine than the areas.
Right.
And his wife was homesick for the cuisine of Tetouan, where the cuisine is more Sephardic in nature because of many Sephardic Jews who fled from Spain settled in northern Morocco. So there was a slight different flavor.
Uh-huh.
And she would bring in cooks from Tetouan to Azemmour so that they could train the young women in the village in the art of cooking that she liked. And I mean, really, that must have been about 1850, 1875. And I mean, I was.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I was. Anyway, that's the story.
That's funny. So can you tell me, what are some of the differences? Because, when we think of the studying a formal, gastronomical, education, we think of French. And I know that there is a lot of French influence in Morocco. Would you say that these schools are distinctly different in nature of how they run their programs?
Well, it's not the I'm not talking about schools here. I'm talking about home cooks and the styles. I mean, Morocco, if you can imagine, is very similar in climate and topography to where I live here in Southern California.
Okay.
So there's mountains and there's snow. There's the Sahara where there's sand and you don't get seafood. And then there's 2,000 kilometers of coastline and then the very fertile plains like California. So the produce and the ingredients are very similar. I mean, they're Mediterranean.
Perfect.
It's just that we combine them in a different way than they do on the other side of the Mediterranean.
Right.
But to differentiate between the north of Morocco and, let's say, the area around Casablanca, as I was saying, in northern Morocco, Tangier, Tetouan, in the Rif area, Morocco for 50 years was a protectorate.
Mm-hmm.
Half of it was French and half of it was Spanish. And so the town I'm talking about in northern Morocco happened to be in the Spanish area of Morocco before it became independent in 57. So to give you a background, the dishes in northern Morocco, in addition to having a Jewish or a Sephardic Jewish influence from Spain, had used, olive oil and paprika in a liberal manner. And the Sephardic Jews were very fond of sweets. So there's pastries that are different than the Arab style, which you would find south of the, Tetouan area.
Is that like the Bastilla chicken pastry?
Well, the Bastilla is really a specialty from Fez.
Oh.
But originally, historically, probably, yes, might have migrated. Nobody's quite sure about Bastilla because there's similar dishes even in southern France. And the Bastilla, the sweetness also originated a lot of it in Turkey with those phyllo dough pastries because the Sephardic Jews migrated from, all around the Mediterranean after they had to leave Spain. And before, I mean, in biblical times, they were already traveling around the Mediterranean. But that style of cooking maybe migrated from the east towards Spain and then down into North Africa. So, but Bastilla, at this point, it's a mixture of sweet shredded chicken and spices like cinnamon and ginger and saffron and sugar and cilantro and parsley and scrambled eggs.
I just find it so fascinating. Yeah, when you mentioned the sweet aspects and then.
But in Morocco now, Bastila is thought of, it's a specialty from Fez, and the Fassi, the inhabitants of Fez, feed it or offer it to newlyweds on the night of their wedding to wish them a life as sweet as a Bastila.
Oh, wonderful. So, you know, I have a more limited knowledge of Moroccan food than you. No kidding. But you know, I see, you know, it's really taken off. I see people trying to preserve lemons you know, tinkering around with harissa more and more often. And it's, as you just kind of, you know, suggested or alluded to just now, it is such a richly varied cuisine that it's really hard to say, you know, Moroccan fill in the blank, you know, flavored something.
Sorry.
Oh, no problem. So I think that this book is also a really great primer in a lot of classic dishes. And I was just wondering how you chose some of these, you know, the couscous with turkey and...
That's good.
And you also have a preserved lemon recipe. And yeah. I love the vegetables. There's a salad of Belgian endives. And harissa and harira, that bean stew. So, yeah, tell me a little bit more about, and okay. I know you've probably been cooking these in your cooking classes, but.
I do. Actually, funnily enough, I have been teaching people how to preserve lemons since the late 70s.
Okay.
It was completely unknown at that time, as was couscous, really. But preserved lemons is quintessentially Moroccan. And if you don't make your own, go home, make them right now, because there's really no good commercial source.
Okay.
And I have to stress that, because many lemons that I see floating in jars of water, they're not preserved. They're just lemons floating in jars of water. I get on my high horse. Sorry.
Absolutely. Please do.
But, they're decorative items. And but the recipe that I give in all my books really is from my great aunt who taught me. She lived in Algeria and Morocco, and she was my mentor. So I preserve lemons only in salt. And in Morocco, traditionally, you do not add flavorings. I mean, of course you can, but adding the chili peppers and the laurier, the bay leaf, and, you know, that's really more Algerian. But if you follow my method, which is lemon and salt, the only ingredient you really need is patience. Preserve those lemons. You have to wait 4 weeks.
It's
otherwise,
like,
they're not preserved.
Right.
I'm done. I won't say anything.
Thank you so much for clarifying, because I you know, it's like salt cured lemons, like a dry cure rather than a wet brine of some sort. Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
It's really a salt cure, because when you end up with the liquid, it has to turn into a salted syrup. It's a jam. It's just preserved in salt. And so when you use it, of course you use the pulp and you use the rind. Mm-hmm. And in my books, I give recipes for A, B, and C, and also the syrup. There's no reason to throw anything out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's so easy. And here, of course, I'm so fortunate. I have a lemon tree in my backyard.
Oh.
But how did I pick my recipes? It was hard because, first of all, many Moroccan recipes are classics. You know, some tagines are, it's a classic dish. There's a history behind it, like the tagine faya with a sweet onion, caramelized almonds and cinnamon and ginger, and that kind of topping you use in celebrations.
Okay.
The tagine, the classic, is a tagine of chicken, olives, and preserved lemons and artichoke hearts. So wherever you go in Morocco, you have a version of that. So what I do in my book is actually I have updated without forsaking the flavors. I mean, I use less fat, for example. I will tell you to use chicken thighs because I think they have more flavor than chicken breasts or a whole chicken or... You know, and you can use frozen artichokes, that's fine. You don't find here, I don't anyway, very common, the tiny little cocktail artichokes. But so I give you a way to make the recipe taste really good using the ingredients you have basically in your supermarket.
Wonderful.
And, but the couscous with turkey, that's a novelty for me, and I really wanted to put it in this book because usually couscous you make with lamb or beef.
Right. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, but I live, well, in Darzitoun is located in one of Morocco's most agricultural areas, the Doukala. And the Doukala is famous for its turkeys.
Okay.
So in the book, I tell you, I went to visit a turkey farmer, and she had a turkey ready, and she made me her turkey couscous, and I swooned because I had never thought of using turkey and couscous, you know. So that's how, that's from a farmer in the Doukala. The endive salad you mentioned, I give also recipes from my family and my mother's French. My grandmother was French, my maternal grandmother. And so we used to go every 31st of December for the Réveillon. I forget the name in English, I'm sorry. New Year's Eve.
Okay.
I have moments, senior moments.
No worries.
So, but endive, you find in Casablanca, you find all over Morocco, because as you said, there is a slight French influence, not much.
Okay.
But the greens and the endive would be, and so the endive, you go to the marché and you buy your endives. You can buy your pâté, you can buy your truffles, you can buy anything you find in a French marché, in big marché all over Morocco, or big a European style market all over Morocco. You know, mushrooms, we get chanterelles, we get, I mean, anything you can imagine in a farmer's market here, you will find in Casablanca, Marrakesh, and Fez in the big cities.
Well, it looks beautiful, and it sounds like you've really honed and fine-tuned some of the recipes that you've been cooking over a while. Maybe
I have.
Yeah,
Thank you.
In this collection. Excellent. We're just going to cut to a quick little commercial interlude, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
All right, we're back chatting more with Kitty Morse, the author of Mint Tea and Minarets. I should also note that this book has already received an award in 2013 for Gourmand World Cookbook Awards, and it was a finalist in the San Diego Book Awards as well. So, Kitty, we were just talking a little bit about some classic dishes, preserved lemon and other ingredients, but the title... dish, or it's not really a dish, it's a drink, is mint tea. And I confess I have been to Morocco for a couple weeks. And I, of course, noticed that mint tea is the first thing that people give you to show hospitality. And it's not like your dried mint tea. It's like a fresh sprigs in tea. So tell me more about that. Why is it so prevalent?
Well, it's mint tea has become or is the national beverage of Morocco, and in Morocco we make it with fresh mint, usually fresh spearmint, or the mint that you find in your backyard that you can't get rid of. And there's a difference between the Moroccan mint tea and the Tunisian, where they do use dried mint. But when it's not sprigs we use in Morocco; it's bunches. So. The green tea, and you have to make it with Chinese green tea. Japanese green tea or other green teas will not do, because they've been treated differently. They're a bit smokier. So if you have Chinese green tea, gunpowder green, Formosa oolong, and so you steep, and it's the kind of beverage, yes, you drink all the time, all over Morocco. Like, you know, some people here in the United States are fueled with coffee. Well, in Morocco, we're fueled with sweet, very sweet mint tea. It started about in the 1850s when the British were looking for a new markets for their tea they were bringing in from India. And
oh.
They found that the Moroccan market was quite receptive. So the base of it is green. It's Chinese green tea, and it's served in one of those pot-bellied teapots with a pointed lid, and you can find them all over the Internet these days. And you steep the green tea for a few minutes, and then you stuff your teapot with mint, fresh mint leaves. So when I buy mint, I buy bunches, and I stuff at least one bunch in my in my teapot to make maybe 4 or 5 cups. And you sweeten it to taste, and it can be very, very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Or when I teach, I go moderately with the sugar because you know, our palates are not as used to the syrupy sweet mint tea that you get in Morocco. But tradition, there's a protocol to drinking mint tea. As you say, everywhere you go, you're offered mint tea, whether you're bargaining for a rug or you're visiting somebody, or you can't escape it.
Right.
So you might as well enjoy it.
It seems like a sign of you know, general greetings.
It's a way to say hello.
It
is. Your meal will start with mint tea and it will end with mint tea, and the protocol says that you sip it in small glasses. You know, you're not going to drink a mug of this. But so you're supposed to drink or to sip 3 glasses of mint tea before you take your leave. That's the polite way of doing things if you go visiting in Morocco. And if you know that if you go in a rug bazaar, then they will ply you with mint tea until you buy a rug.
I did experience that. So, I mean, I think it's just such a wonderful way to use mint. I know a lot of people who have mint plants that grow like crazy in the summer, so it's really addictive too.
It is, and you know, I love to make it iced. It's not traditional, but I make my Moroccan mint tea and I put it in the fridge, and that's what I drink all summer. I love it iced. And a very I don't know if you in your part of the world if you can grow a lemon verbena.
Oh yes, absolutely.
Oh, then what you do, and it's another Moroccan custom, you can add mint and a few leaves of lemon verbena.
Just fresh.
And if you want an infusion with no green tea, if you're drinking this at night, skip the tea. I very often do just the mint and the lemon verbena and a bit of sugar.
Right.
And you just stuff
the whole, like, leaves and stem and all, just, you know, plop it in there.
Yeah, oh, the mint, leaves and stem and all I do is I take away the little tie and I rinse the mint under running water and I stuff the whole thing. In fact, I have 7 bunches in my fridge right now because I'm doing an event in Los Angeles on Wednesday and I'm bringing my bunches of mint. You're not used to using that amount of mint, so I get... too little mint, and so I have to bring my own.
I see what you mean. You're like, no, really, I need this much.
Actually, you know where you buy the best, and I find the least expensive and really good mint is in Mexican and Vietnamese or Chinese markets because they make use of bunches of mint, especially the Vietnamese.
Oh.
So I would go directly there because otherwise, I mean, it's basically a weed and you pay an arm and a leg.
I know, right. All right. So tell me more about harissa. This is a condiment that I see a lot of folks hesitant about because it looks like it might be really, really spicy.
Oh.
But it's actually more smoky, right?
Well, it depends on the peppers you use. The recipe that I give, because Moroccans do not like picante food.
Okay.
The Tunisians and the Algerians do, but the Moroccans have adopted harissa from Tunisia. It's actually a Tunisian condiment. And so in Morocco, if you make your own, and you'll notice my recipe, if you make it, it's really not that picante.
No,
it depends on the quality of peppers or chilies that I would use.
Okay.
And I use guajillo, and, you know, so it's fairly mild. But if I want picante, I will add cayenne, I will add habanero. And so you make your own harissa and you serve it on the side in Morocco, especially with brochette, with shish kebabs. And I give you the recipe because shish kebabs, it's a street food.
Mm.
And so you automatically serve your brochette with harissa and cumin because you're going to dip your cube of lamb in harissa and in cumin.
But strictly,
you also serve it in Morocco as a side to couscous because we we serve couscous and then broth on the side. My grandfather always had his broth on the side, and you add the harissa to the broth, and then you put that on top of your couscous.
Oh, nice little, like, a sauce or dipping.
Yeah, like a sauce. Yeah. And so, you know, really it depends. It's up to you. It's up to your palate. So it's quite common. I see it a lot now. There's a lot of chefs using
harissa. Well, it's such a bright and beautiful, rich color, and it just has a lot of depth of flavor, and you know, whereas you might expect just heat, it's a lot more than that.
It's a lot more because Morocco, and I have to say, I'm always, because I've written a book on North African food as well, and Tunisian and Algerian is very good, but Moroccan, I think, is more subtle because to a Moroccan's palate, what's important is the blend of spices. So when you cook in the same dish, you have beef or lamb or chicken with ginger and cinnamon and paprika and salt and pepper and cilantro and you have to, and saffron, gosh, I'm not for like a saffron. The art of making the dish is to make sure that you can taste the palette of flavor. So you don't want to add heat to this because you won't get the palette of flavors. And that's what Moroccan cooking is all about.
Wow. It is a really, really varied blend sometimes. And I really appreciate that. So tell me, we only have a couple minutes left, but what else might you be working on now that you've written this 12-year project memoir, aside from teaching as usual?
Well, I'm having fun. I'm promoting the book, and I give presentations of Moroccan cuisine and culture. But funnily enough, about a week ago, I signed a new contract. I am doing a second edition of a book on edible flowers.
Oh, wonderful.
So I'm actually now working on, munching my way to my friends' gardens and various places.
I can't wait for that. That's
yeah,
a topic.
It's a sweet. It's a gift book, and it's very pretty, and I'm, you know, making sure every recipe works, and so that's what I'm testing at the moment. But you know, when I want comfort food, I go directly to Moroccan food.
Oh, very cool. I can't wait to keep posted on that project as well.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
It's been great fun, and please keep in touch.
Absolutely. And everyone can check out Mint Tea and Minarets out from La Caravane Books.
Yes, and they're all on my website, kittymorse.com. All my books are on my website, and so are recipes and my forthcoming appearances.
Events.
I try and keep that up.
All right, great. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Ooh, I like the way you do.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.